And the reason I think it's important for us to do storytelling is that in my life, and I think historically in our lives, storytelling has been a way for us to understand ourselves better and to come to grips with our lives and to put form and order into our thinking about our lives. If you notice, one of the activities that people carry on at funerals is telling stories about the person who's died. And stories somehow resonate with people. You reach down into yourself, and when something traumatic has happened to me, I find that I can't put it to rest in any sense until I've made it into a story in my head, till I've got it down to a story, till I've figured it out. I've placed some sense of, so it isn't chaos, so it's some orderly, it has some roots and it has a cause or a beginning, and then it has the particulars that support that and the precise concrete images. And then it comes to some kind of an end, because I don't want it to just not. I don't want it to be open-ended. I think in our history, stories are intriguing to people. I mean, biblical stories are so... Bible is shot through with stories. I'm going to read you one in a minute. Stories are ways of teaching ourselves about things. They're proofs for things. They're, you know, when you're having an argument, you often pull a story up to support your argument because you want to prove your point of view. We tell stories about everyday events, and we like to tell stories, and we like to listen to stories. The stories can demonstrate in our lives competence or incompetence of somebody or something or of the universe. They can talk about love, they can talk about hate, they can talk about the complexity of love and hate together, frustrations and solutions to frustrations. They talk about hope and hopelessness. They often illustrate a moral in life. They teach a life skill. Women tell birth stories. When I was pregnant the first time, I found many, many, many women who told me their birth stories. And it was almost like a compulsion. It was very interesting to me because these birth stories, and people would, my Aunt Jo, I'm going to tell you a story. My Aunt Josephine, who at that time was probably in her 80s, and whose son, her firstborn, was 50, told me the story of his infancy. And she talked about how in those days, the doctor that she had, she was a Missouri Synod Lutheran at that point, and the doctor was there German, and it was an old German doctor, and he was well respected in Chicago. But his orders were to Josephine, she told me, to nurse the baby every 4 hours. You didn't want to spoil babies. So you nurse the baby every 4 hours. And she said he would start to cry after 2.5 hours. And I would be full of milk after 2.5 hours. And she said I would sit by his crib and we would both cry until the 4 hours were up. And she began to weep. And here she was, 80 years old, and retelling the story. And then she got a little bit crafty look in her eye. And she said, you know, I finally decided that I would break the rule, but I didn't tell anyone. it was such a relief, you know, to her, to me. I mean, the tension that poor woman was still carrying with her. But finally she could say, well, I decided to break the rule. And then she would, I don't know how long she went after the 2.5 hours were up, that were the right amount of time to go by. But her advice to me, she was giving me advice. She was saying, if a doctor tells you something that doesn't ring true, don't do it, and feed the baby when it's hungry. And, you know, I got many stories like that during pregnancy. So stories are just shot through our culture, and they're wonderful. And we all like to read stories and hear stories read to us. And, you know, childhood is made up of stories, practically. So I'm wondering what some of the issues are I've been a single person in Holden Village for the last couple of weeks. I am not a single person in actual fact, but we've all been single at some point in our lives, and some people are single and not single and sort of moving back and forth, but I haven't had a family here in the last couple of weeks, and it's been a different experience for me. There's been more loneliness because I'm accustomed to having people around. So I've become accustomed to loneliness, and one of my children is going to arrive today, and now I'm aware that I've kind of adjusted. Loneliness doesn't seem like loneliness anymore. It just seems like a luxury of time. So I'm not an authority, but you all are on what we mean by singleness. If you yourself are single, we could talk about some issues that are present in your lives that you might want to tell stories about. Or if you're thinking of a single person that you care about, that you could tell stories about that person's life. So what are some of the issues that occur for single people that are issues that need the kind of order or resolution that stories can provide? Can you all tell me?
Finding compatible friends.
Finding compatible friends, okay, good. That's certainly, and you could talk about that being a journey, you know, a set of things that you try, and some could be stories of failure and some could be stories of success.
Meeting people of compatibility.
Meeting people. And compatibility implying that you have certain needs or standards or desires.
There's something in common.
Mm-hmm. How about some of the rest of you?
Well, I found when I first, I'd never been single, it seemed. I married on my 18th birthday. Was married for 45 years and suddenly was single when I was widowed. And suddenly I had no friends because all my friends were married. And they, I don't know why. The divorced women have the same problem. So that I went through about 4 months of saying, where is everybody? And because I'm stubborn and because I'm a fighter, I said, well, I'll just make new friends. And that's what I set about doing. And I have a totally new circle of friends.
Isn't that interesting?
Out on the perimeter are still those married people, but I don't meet with them socially. We call each other occasionally to say, how are things? Or if we see each other in the mall, you know, hi. But we don't get together socially at all or share confidences like we used to. My friends now are all that I've met within the last 5 years.
And it makes you wonder, what is friendship? And how deep does friendship go? And what is the meaning of this? Is it something you can lose or gain, depending on
So I found
issues.
Places where there were other single people, mm-hmm. and that's where I went.
Mm-hmm. How about someone else? What are some of the issues of singleness?
Well, my issue right now is feeling complete with my time of being single and going about in the most healthy way I can, leaving singleness and going back to coupleness, and just knowing that I want that in my heart.
So you want to feel complete as a single person, you don't want
to... I want to be complete with my cycle of being single mm-hmm. this time. And I feel complete with it. And I'm looking at, though I'm single right now, I'm looking at preparing myself for being in a relationship again and learning everything that I've learned from before about how relationships are unhealthy and understanding how that came about in my life and leaving it and going on to something mm-hmm. new, being in a relationship in a new way.
I can remember when I was a single woman teaching at Valparaiso University, living alone in an apartment, at first feeling quite anxious and restless and wanting always to fill my time with people. But as the years went by during that period in my life, I found myself turning down invitations more and more because I suddenly discovered, not suddenly, but over time I discovered that there were people who would invite me to do things, whose company, although I enjoyed to some extent, I preferred my own company. I started to prefer my own company to just anybody to keep me busy. And I got pickier about, And I thought, this is probably growth. This is probably healthy. That I can start to not need people so much and like my own company. So it sounds like you're in that place now where you're feeling quite good about where you are and what you're, who you are as a single person. And that is, that's a good story to tell, and it's a story that needs telling, I think, over and over. How about someone else? Well, I chair the Division for Church and Society board, and we just came out with a sexuality study document for the ELCA, and lots of parishes around the country have been using the study document on sexuality, human sexuality, to talk within their congregations about issues of sexuality. And I think that the Lutheran Church, and probably most Christian churches, although I don't know, is provides a sort of intense complexity for single people around issues of sexuality. Historically, we've been told you have sex in marriage and not out. And for people who have decided to have long-term relationship with someone to whom they don't wish to marry, with whom they don't wish to marry, or if people aren't going to marry or are not given the opportunity to marry, then yet they continue to be sexual beings, and the sexual aspects of our nature is a gift from God. It leaves single people without a way to be sexual beings if their notion of what's appropriate in their relationship with God and their church and themselves and their body includes a sense that you can't have sex outside marriage. And I think that there are many occasions when that is not a healthy choice. I think, for example, single older people who can't afford to get married because of the way their social security or insurance or those sorts of issues. Should we insist, or should we tell them they cannot have a sexual relationship? How about young people? Maybe someone is, a young couple's in love, but they are going to college and their money for college depends on they're being unmarried, and I don't know, I mean, that maybe there's an argument somewhere in there that there's room for I think it's an issue. I think it's difficult for Christians who are committed to think about what the right stewardship is of sexuality. If you think that what we are as people is a gift from God, and that God loves us and makes us as whole people in God's image, and the image of God includes our being sexual beings. I think that for single people must be a very complex issue. So I'm imposing one on the group, but maybe that's one.
And it's made more complex, as you say, by the hierarchy of our churches.
Yes.
Who assume that they can give laws for our behavior when it's my understanding that the Protestant view is that we have but one law, which is the law of love as seen in Christ. And it is not for human institutions to pass laws on human behavior, so long as we can follow that one law of love.
Mm-hmm. And love one another as I have loved you. I loved Verlaine's matins this morning on kissing.
Oh, what do you say? Yes. I wasn't there.
He recommends kissing in all its forms, and he thinks that everyone should kiss lots.
I can see his eyes getting bigger.
and your problem was illustrated last night in the song, Erotically Confused.
Oh, yes, sure, in the concert last night. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting. What about money? For single people, is money an issue? A sense of security, a sense of being secure financially, is that easier for people in pairs than it is for people who are really dependent ultimately on themselves? Is that an issue for you folks, or is money okay?
It takes an adjustment. I had to tell myself constantly when I first became single that no one else was going to put any money in my checkbook or my savings account, you know, that I had to do this on my income, not a dual income.
Mm-hmm. So simpler housing, perhaps, less expensive housing.
You make some adjustments. Mm-hmm. And you usually have kids to say, I'm taking, you know, we can't do this anymore, we can't do this anymore, you know. You have to make adjustments because you're one person made a comment yesterday that because he was single he was able to do all this traveling, and I argue that because you're paying the rent, you know, rent for
your home expenses remain the same.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I found,
although you don't have two people spending mm-hmm. the
I found it costs me less to live because I don't have to buy men's clothes or men's tools and, you know, and a new car and all the things that men like to have.
Yeah.
So it's my overall expenses are less.
Right.
But the housing is exactly the same.
But you're talking about some of those things that you mentioned are wants. They aren't needs. Your basic mm-hmm. needs.
No. But that's the difference, is I'm managing on less money because I don't have those things.
Yeah.
But you can make an adjustment in that. If you have a house that's big enough for two people, I'm thinking of your basic suburban houses. In Minnesota, Wisconsin, it's three bedrooms. Main floor, family room, all the things that the family has. One person doesn't need all that. If you want to make the change, if you want to make a change that's going to cut down your monthly expenses, it's there are possibilities, there are ways to do that.
You can rent a room out.
Rent a room, you can move, you can sell, you can buy a smaller place.
There are greater needs for money for singles in many cases, mm-hmm. Such as to have a social life. How do you take people out to dinner? How do you go to the theater? How do you do the things that you need for a social life when the couples can have their own social life without that?
You're going outside of your home for all your social needs. I mean, unless I have people in often, but most of the time you're going outside of your home.
Sounds to me like you need to learn to cook.
I'm starting.
Good.
But I'm not sure how that fits in. It's really hard. I don't hear you.
It sounds to me like you were describing a social life during married years in which you depended on another person to provide hospitality to friends. And now you're finding that for you to have hospitality, you have to go out into the commercial world and spend money. And if hospitality is all you're talking about, then you can do hospitality in your home. Otherwise, when you have a partner, if you have a partner, you and your partner can also go out into the commercial world and spend money on fun and hospitality.
Plus, I wonder if he's throwing in there buying dinner for someone else, taking someone else to the show. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, that's what I was.
Yeah.
But when you're married, you have to do that too.
I don't know. Why don't you just say, let's go Dutch?
Yes.
You know, if she wants your company, she'll go.
Maybe I'm afraid that she may not want my car.
Well, maybe she can't afford it that day, but maybe, you know, she'll come up with an alternative.
You know, it's fine. Go a cheaper for thing to do.
We potluck a lot.
Yeah, potluck. Go.
I like.
What about community?
Taking her room.
Friends, community.
I find most of my social life, other than through a couple of close friends, is through organizations that I belong to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of potlucks and mm-hmm. and simple entertainments, getting together with good music and a lot of conversation.
Mm-hmm. I actually have for years been organizing a group of women that I intend to live with when I'm retired. And we've got, because we figure the men are all going to die statistically. I mean, they can live there if they're alive, you know. But and we own a six flat, and we're going to just have the whole six flat be filled with all these single people who are all older. My women's group, lots of women friends, a few men if they're still alive, and they take care of their bodies, maybe they will be. And we're going to hire sweet young things to come and rub our feet and provide our meals and dish out our meds if we need meds. And we're going to live communally. We're going to eat communally, live communally. I mean, I can't imagine living alone as an older single person. Oh, it would be awful.
So you have this place bought now?
That's where we live. It's a six flat that we own with a couple other families.
What is a six flat?
Oh, it's six apartments. It's a Chicago term, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But we're going to put an elevator.
We call them duplexes.
That's a duplex.
Yeah,
two, four, six.
I came from a larger community in the Seattle area. I spent a year here in a smaller community. I like the small community, but I would like to know what others might think. I'm concerned that I might not fit in, or there's not that many single people if I were to go and locate in a small community, a small town.
So you're sort of afraid.
I came from a small town in Iowa, but went to Seattle for all these years, and I'm just not sure that I would, that you're socially acceptable. And maybe that's old.
Take one of that. Yeah, so there's a run into the same problem we have here. You know, with not many people you make.
I just moved to a real small town in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. After spending 37 years in St. Paul, moved to a town of 500 people.
And what did it feel like? Do you feel like you don't get, you're out of touch with everybody, you're not included, or do you feel
not
like you're...
If I was passive about it, probably. But if you get out there and do things, there's most everybody is married family. And they, by necessity, I think, have their own program because they have to deal with their kids and just working around the kids' schedule. But there's, I just kind of grab the moments that are grabbable. You know, expecting to spend lots and lots of time with any particular person or bunches of people hasn't worked or doesn't work.
Why did you choose as a single person to move to a smaller community? I'm curious about that.
Job?
Yeah, it was the job opportunity, but it was something I thought about for a while. Mm-hmm. And that, but it was a move in a string of moves. Mm-hmm. It's not the last one. It wasn't the first one.
Well, I'm going to give you an assignment in a minute, but I want to talk a little bit about what I think are some things to think about as you're writing stories.
Could I add another risk thing? I mean, you mentioned money, but and security. Tied to that for me is risk-taking, and there's a part of me, because I'm single, I can take risks, mm-hmm. because nobody else is in, people close to me are not impacted in the same way. But there's also a greater fear of taking risks because I do it more alone. And so moving to a new community, making changes in my life is to cut myself off from the communities that I have. And it puts me out there.
Yeah, good point.
And sometimes that's tied to money also, it's not as easy for me, or it doesn't seem to be as easy for me to take off and go to school for a year as it is for friends who are married and have mm-hmm. another income.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I would just like a show of hands on a question. Do you feel that our society is basically designed to be a bifurcated society, basically that as a single person you're out of step or out of sync or not right somehow? How many people feel like that compared to that being single is perfectly regular and okay in this society? How many people feel like you're out of sync and out of step being single?
And especially in the church.
And especially in the church, that's an interesting indictment. Well, not very many of you feel that way. That's good.
Could I ask how many people have always been single? I have.
How many people would?
Always.
I've always been legally single.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I'm going to read you about that. I was married for 14 years, but it was on paper.
I'm going to read you a story of a single, actually three single people who live together in the Bible. And I'll point out a few things about the story. It's a short story, but it's interesting. First, I want to tell you that two-parent families in our society are down in the somewhere in the 20s now in those percentages, that the classic Dick and Jane kind of family is now like a quarter of the households in our society. So statistically, people don't live that way anymore. People don't live in classic mother, father, kids family. So there are a lot of people out there that are looking for new community, new ways to live, and creative ways to live. But there's real, the second thing I want to mention to you is that I asked Dan Erlander, who is a friend of ours, a child once said about Dan Erlander, he's read thousands and thousands of Bibles. So he's the Bible study teacher here now, as you all know. And I said, tell me what would be a good story to read about a person who's single in the Bible. And he said, he started thinking about it. He said, he named person after person after person that was single in the Bible. He said, well, Jesus to start with. Mm-hmm. And then he went on all the Marys, Lazarus and two Marys living together, which is one I'm going to, part of one I'm going to read you. There are just so many single people in the Bible. So this is not a new phenomenon that there, you know, the society is shot through with single people. This particular story, think about how it's introduced. Think about introduction as setting up a framework. The body of the story as being enriched and made much more meaty by detail. And then think how the story comes to an end and then goes on to focus on something else. Because the stories I'm going to ask you to write should do those same kinds of things. And the story does not have to be a literal level, concrete thing. Stories can be myths. You know, stories can be abstraction. They don't have to, your story to express what the feeling or the idea you want to express does not have to be an actual literal level truth. I mean, there can be magic in it. But it has to work on a literal level. It has to make sense so that when people read it, they're grokking, they're tracking with you. So this Bible story is a concrete story, which is true, but the story I will ask you to write is not necessarily true. This is not the whole, the two Marys and Lazarus, but this is one little bit of it. Well, you'll hear. Jesus anointed at Bethany. Now remember, these three folks, three single folks living together, a man and two women. There's a model there. Think about it. 6 days before the Passover. So the writer starts by saying where this story is occurring in time, in the sort of cycle of life. Jesus arrived at Bethany. Now we know not only when, but where and who. Where Lazarus lived. Now this is a sexist story. It doesn't say where Lazarus and Martha and Mary lived. It's not the two Marys, it's Martha and Mary. Right? One of them is the kitchen and one of them is at the foot of the teacher. Okay, so now we know who and where and what, when. Okay, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Okay, so there's a little historical reference, too, about his history with these people. So in one sentence, this author has brilliantly given us the answers to many of our questions about what's happening here. Here, now that we've been brought up to speed, we know the history, now we're going to start the present. Here, a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. There's so few words being told here to tell so much content. It's one of the brilliant things about the Bible. It's really pretty well written, actually. I mean, I'm an English teacher, and I like it. So we've got two sentences. We already have the answers to almost all of our basic questions. Who, what, where, all the W's. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Did you just picture it? You know, all these people reclining at the table, and then Martha served, just two words, and here's Martha sort of, you know, can you imagine all that work serving, and Jesus was there, and it was important? And, I mean, if you lived in a little group of three people, how would you make the decision who served that meal, and who got to recline at the table?
And who got the most out of it?
The fragrance of the perfume. Imagine making a film of this story. I mean, there's a meal going on, people bustling around, people reclining. And then this is the sort of central incident. This is what the writer wants us to visualize and smell. This writer actually wants us to smell this story. They ought to have a little scratch and sniff right here in the Bible. But one of the disciples, and we've now had three sentences. No, we've had more than three sentences, but we've had three verses. Because one of the sentences was Martha served. This is the fourth verse. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. So now we not only have the past and the present, but we have a forewarning or a kind of a looking ahead into the future. It's like in a movie where you hear the low, eerie, dangerous music for a second saying, this is symbolizing something bad. Something bad is going to come out of this. Judas Iscariot is here, and he's later to betray him. So that's okay to have in a story. You don't have to have your story have all the loose ends wrapped up. So, but one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, so now we find out their disciples reclining around this table while Martha is working real hard serving him. Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Quote, why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. We all know Judas Iscariot's in our lives. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, in case you missed the point, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used it to help himself to what was put into it. So there's a little intrigue in this story. We have a thief in our midst. And the thief is trying to control us and advise us and prevent us from worshiping in the way that we think is right. So the thief isn't just stealing money, which a community could maybe sustain, but the thief is poisoning our way of behaving, doing bad stuff, telling us not to pour the perfume on Jesus. Jesus said, replied, leave her alone. So now here's a conflict. The story has a conflict in it, and we're now at the seventh verse. Boy, how many of us could get this much into these few sentences? Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was meant that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. And that's really the end of the story. Right there. If there's one more little bit, but Jesus really ends the story there by making his point. And Jesus is kind of wrapping up of his what he wants us to learn. This story is illustrative. This is a moral. This is a lesson. The poor, it's a lesson that all of us, I think, have to struggle with because we're not comfortable with this lesson. This is one of those that Dan said this morning in Bible study. Remember, you can throw out, if you're a liberal, you could throw out the parts of the Bible you don't like. If I could do that, I would throw this out because I'm uncomfortable with Jesus saying the poor you will always have with you because it sounds to me like he's saying give up on the poor and just... But then if you look at the story in terms of the point he's making, it sounds to me like he's saying, I'm going to die today, and she has got her eye on the ball. She's doing the right thing. And Judas Iscariot is trying to throw us off balance, and that's a problem. So the tension that Jesus is talking about is not a prescription about the poor. It's something else that's going on around this dinner table with the people reclining. Which I love. But so that's the end of it. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. And then it does go on to say in 9, 10, and 11, Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well, for on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him. So if you were filming this, you would sort of start with a panoramic, giving the location and the history. You would focus in on a couple of little events at this dinner table that were quite riveting. The conflict, first of all, the pouring of the oil, and then the conflict that went on. And then there would be the crowd outside the door. So then you'd back off with your film and you'd pan to this crowd outside the door, and you know, then the story would go on. But really, that little story is an intense little story. Each of us can tell stories in lots of ways about lots of things, but I would like each of you to take a few minutes now and tell and outline on the piece of paper I've given you, just outline what you think would be a good story about singleness. Positive, negative, triumphant, failure. But give yourself a little outline. What would be the beginning? What would be the middle with a few specific images? And what would be the end? And Tate Ministry will take 5 minutes now of downtime.
Getting something right in.
Oh, I see. I think it's a
pencil. I understand that some people would have a story that they would not feel comfortable sharing, but I bet there are some people here who would like to tell us what their story is going to be about, or what their outline is, or can share their story in a very encapsulated form. So who's got something there that they want to tell us about?
I'll tell you about my story.
Okay, good.
Okay, this is a scene. You come into this affluent house overlooking the river. You know this couple's comfortable financially. Everything's, you know, green in the yard, taken care of. So all their survival needs, you know, are there. The Mercedes is in the yard, the four-wheel drive Toyota.
They have a big pile.
Oh, yeah.
Man.
No doubt about it. But you go in the house and they're stressed. You can just sense it. You can cut it with a knife. And then finally there's the conflict. And then the separation, and then the self. You go over and there's a contrast from this style of living to a more simple style of living. But then the happiness with the more simplicity, because all the big stuff took so much time and energy and management. Where the other, you can be messy, nobody cares, it's a little house messy anyway. And then the survival needs are still met at the small house, just like they were at the big house. You can only eat so much food. You can only leave so many lights on, or turn so many lights off. And the true needs of the people separate. And then there's the openness between the couple, and their needs are separated. And then they go separate ways, and then the person are happy going separately. And then the compatibility comes when they are able to find different people who are compatible or just happy on their own.
So the tension is resolved.
Mm-hmm.
So you start out with two major things, one tension, two affluence. Mm-hmm. And you take each of those threads and follow them through and resolve them. Very nice. Thank you.
Well, you did better than I did.
No, I just reported what you did. Who else has a story to tell us?
I do. I'll expose myself to you all. I think I just read this. I think it's complete the way it is. Her parents were divorced, and her father committed suicide when she was 14. She had no model for the man-woman relationship. She had three unwhole relationships. The first man was still a boy. The second man was almost a woman. And the third man looked very masculine outside, but was hollow inside. So she accepted her singlehood
and related to everyone without polarity, not looking for a partner. She practiced respect to everyone. As she looked with no investment, she started seeing healthy models of marriage. As soon as she became a complete individual, she married the right person for the right reasons.
Very nice. Once again, you set the stage with the childhood problems, and then you gave the concrete details of three bad relationships, and then you managed a resolution. You didn't tell us how that happened, except that there was some arrival of wholeness in the agent of all of this, mm-hmm. and then a new thing, the possibilities for new things.
Thanks.
And of course, I would say the possibilities for new things, as you said, don't have to include a marriage.
Right.
But being whole, you're a child of God, you're a whole person. But you just have to accept yourself and sort of heal yourself. And you're not only whole when you're in a partnership.
I think the conclusion I feel is that you can't be in a partnership, really, unless you're whole. Mm-hmm. Unless you're single, I mean, singularly mm-hmm. whole.
That's excellent. Yeah, that's good. Who else has a story?
Well, I've just made an outline of what I had mentioned earlier about making new friends and so forth. Mm-hmm. And set the stage as a woman alone in a house that had once contained a husband, children, pets, friends, family, and all the noise and confusion that goes with that. And now she's there and it's quiet, and she's thinking that I need to do something about this. She needs to find replacements for all of the daily dramas that had once been going on there. So the story tells the many ways and means that she found new family, satisfying work, meaningful relationships, and a sense of peace and harmony. Even though she's still alone, she's not lonely.
So you solved the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You explain the history, the roots of the problem, then you demonstrate the problem, the graphicness of the quiet, the aloneness, the bad stuff, and then you explain the steps to resolve that problem. I think you better go home this afternoon and write that story.
It was fun.
Good.
It's still fun.
Who else has a story for us?
I have a story. Part of this story is true because it's me, and part of the story is the way I wish it had been, but eventually was over a period of. I've been single for 12 years, and this is my story, but it happened over 12 years instead of a short time.
Incidentally, one of the good uses of story is to figure out what you wish,
mm-hmm.
and to fantasize and to work. You know, some people say you can't get to the end unless you know what you want in the end, and you visualize it, and then you can get there.
Mm-hmm.
But stories are very good for figuring out what we want. Do that in lots of ways.
And sometimes you can empower other people or help them along their way and help their story be a little different than your own. She found herself single with two children, 10 and 12. She knew that she needed support with her new life and a social life. How could she find her way? She called a friend that she knew had been single for a while and seemed happy and confided her story. The friend invited her to a singles group and kept in touch with her for a while. She showed her a path to singleness and made gentle suggestions, church counseling, and divorce adjustment. The friend found her way to a healthy single life. And I think it's our responsibility, as these numbers, you know, rise of single parent homes or single people, to you know, it's our responsibility to people that are working on wholeness to show them the way. When I became single, I didn't know anyone. We have a bar in town called Bart's. The single person I knew.
It's a place you don't want to go.
Yeah. This was 12 years ago. was the only single person I knew. Penny, she kind of hung out there, you know, so I went and visited her for a while. You know, I mean, I didn't know what to do. I wasn't involved in church. I afraid of it at the time. And I have had, Howard mentioned that the church wasn't accepting of him, and I have found acceptance in the church, and the word I would use would be acceptance when I think of my church, and that's very important. And not everyone does experience that, and I know people that have been asked to leave when they've gotten a divorce and just taken care of. I knew a woman one time, the community rallied around her and her husband when they lost a child. And when they became divorced, a couple of years later, she was asked to leave the church. The same people.
Oh, I just shudder when I hear stories like that.
Yeah.
That's a story that has to be told. That's a story you should write. That's another story you should write. Mm-hmm. And the other good idea in there is the importance of community and supporting one another and forming community consciously. We're such, in our society somehow, we're so isolated, we tend to be. And we have to work at building community. Mm-hmm. And those are all really important ideas that you've given us this morning, I think.
I didn't find any of my help at my church. It's a very large church. And from time to time, the single people make an effort to do social things, but it never lasts very long, and it doesn't include everyone. Mm-hmm. And
I think
it's just very unsatisfying.
Getting single people, I mean, what's meaningful? It isn't so meaningful to sit around and drink coffee together. It's meaningful to do good work together. And if people would take on projects and things, that would be more fun. But that's a separate story. I'm afraid our time is up, and we have to vacate this room so the next group can come in. Dan McNeil is going to be next, and he's wonderful. So I want to thank you all very much for these stories. I think they're wonderful stories. I wish we could hear more of them. And I hope some of you will go home and write yourself a piece of fiction this afternoon. Remember, you can put fantasy, make-believe, myth. You can have weird birds in your stories. You can do anything you want. So story is a fun form to play with and invent. And if you write about troubles, something that's troubling you in your life, you don't even have to start at the right place. You just start somewhere and identify it. Often story is a way to work through that. So I recommend it to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.